This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive.
A community-based fundraising event.
It's 1 p.m. in New York City, 93 degrees at 1 o'clock. Stay tuned for The Positive Mind with Armand DeMille. You're listening to WBAI in New York at 99.5 FM.
Hi, everybody. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial. Bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. And today, we have something interesting for you. As promised, we're going to be talking with Dr. Mona Lisa Schultz. Mona Lisa Schultz, author of The New Feminine Brain, a study in the development of the brain and what we've had to come to, and some new information. Good friend of Christine Northrup's, who's Christine's your neighbor, isn't she?
She lives down the street.
Down the street from me. So the two of you, I could see, kind of run along the same lines. What is the new feminine brain?
Well, the new feminine brain is that we women don't have the brains our mothers had, our grandfathers had, grandfathers. Brain evolves as the world changes. Your brain is like plastic. It molds and shapes to accommodate a changing world. And with the new model brain, there are a few bugs that need to be worked out.
So new model brain, meaning... new neural pathways, different neural pathways, different hormonal messages, different. I mean, what makes it a new brain?
Well, there's four basic areas in the brain. There's mood, anxiety, attention, and memory. Let's just look at attention. There was a study done with little kids who watch too much TV. Their attention spans get less and less, and I can understand that with the way the TV shows are these days. The frames are very quick. Even the newsreels, they have four different lines. So our brains have to change and mold to accommodate every five seconds something changing. And so now our attention in our brain is overwhelmed, being bombarded by sidekicks, by TV, by telephones, cell phones, blackberries, blueberries, cantaloupes, all these different types of ways that we get information.
This is Armand DeMille with you. I'm talking with Dr. Mona Lisa Schultz, who's an MD, PhD, author of The New Feminine Brain. Let's stick with this for a minute. I ask you about the physical nature of the brain, and you tell me about four conceptual parts of the brain. Now, you say one part of the brain is attention. What part of the brain is that? Is that the forebrain, the rear brain, the midbrain, the underbrain, the top brain? What can we physically describe this?
It's like a network, a string of pearls, to quote Glenn Miller. Is it Glenn Miller? String. It's a string of areas of the brain.
I wouldn't remember Glenn Miller.
A string of pearls of areas that are interconnected to create attention. Then there's a string of areas connected to create memory. And then they're same for mood and same for anxiety. And the thing is...
So there's not... I'm sorry to interrupt
you. That's good.
But there's not a specific area of the brain. When we say there are four parts of the brain, what we mean, there are four networks.
Yeah.
And in these networks, the networks are changing. And one of the networks, for example, is the attention span network.
Yes.
Now, I think... Are you saying, Mona Lisa? Mind if I call you Mona Lisa?
You can call me whatever you want. But Mona Lisa's good.
Okay. Are you saying that because the brain is active in a different way, it grows different protein and synthesis and the nerves are different? Because remember, I have a little background in this.
Exactly. So in other words, when you take a plant out of a pot, the roots grow to accommodate that pot. If you get a larger pot, the roots have to grow to the shape of that pot. The web of neuron pathways in our brain for attention and memory and mood are growing to accommodate the universe, the world. And because that world is being shaped differently, our brains have to shape to accommodate it.
Do you think our brains weigh more than they did before? Because I remember new neural pathways added weight.
Yeah, but then when you add things, you take away things because it's called pruning. Through a process called apoptosis, cellular death, and pruning, you remove inessential pathways and add new ones. So, for example, Stevie Wonder's brain. Let's take Stevie Wonder. Stevie Wonder wouldn't have been a Wonder if he could see. He's blind. The areas for visual pathways that would have been in his brain if he saw were probably taken up by auditory areas for music. Whales, the same thing. Because their brains molded around differences in their environment. Same thing with someone who's become blind or had a stroke or adapts to the world that we have with of trauma, of terrorism bombings, of quick changes, fast updates and information. All of this happens to change with the world.
So our brain is adapting, and in the brain adapting, it is physically growing new chemistry.
Yep.
And in the physical, you're saying that there is a physical difference between the brain of today and the brain of last week?
Maybe months, year.
But month by month, the brain can change.
Yes.
Are there certain things that, for example, that will inhibit the development of the brain?
Oh, that's such a great question. You know what will inhibit the development of the brain? Is not changing with the world. For example, a lot of people think dementia is a loss of memory. And actually, my definition for dementia is incapacity to learn new things. One type of dementia is where you can't learn new things. And a lot of times, you notice when people get older, they don't want to change. They want to go to Howard Johnson's, have the same clam strips. They want to take the drive in the same car. They don't need a new car. Why do we need a new car? They stay stuck in a rut. Their brains don't change to accommodate the world. And what happens? They have a greater incidence of dementia. So if you want to grow with the world and sprout new pathways, you're actually lowering your risk for dementia.
So the what you recommend is to keep the mind active and growing.
In 10 different areas. That's the second to the last chapter of the book on memory.
What are the 10 different areas?
Oh, you got to go through the whole thing. It's like my PhD defense. But the first one is there's a chart in there. Are you growing over the hill or are you growing gracefully? And you can see this applies to men too. So it's like a little, you can just test yourself. Will you go to a party if you don't know anybody, meet two people, and will you follow up with them afterwards? Or if there's a party where you don't know anyone, do you avoid the party like the plague? If you avoid the party like the plague, you're more likely to grow old, get in a rut, and dement. The second one is visual space. That's social. Second one is visual spatial. Can you rent a car? Can you rent a car, go to a new city, get a map, and navigate by yourself? If this is something you could do, and you would do, then you're actually tempering your brain for dementia. Alternately, if you don't, then you're more likely to dement, and so on. There's 10 other areas.
Let me see. Let's find them. That's exciting. Here we go. No, I know as an author you could easily run into here. Let's go through.
I'm going to hit the microphone.
This is Armand DeMille with you. We are speaking with Dr. Mona Lisa Schultz, M.D., PhD, neurobiologist. Here, you go through them. So learning and memory, language.
Language is the other one. Do you read two or more books? Do you read two or more books a month? There was a study, the Nun Study, which I'm sure many of your audience members know, that they showed that women nuns, I don't think they have male nuns these days, but women nuns who wrote in their journal and they had a high idea density, they were more likely to not dement, they were less likely to dement. So if you're more literate, if you read, learn, write, you're less likely to dement in that as well.
Television is different than that. You think television is too passive? An involvement?
Well, I'm a proponent of PBS, public television, but you know, you're really learning. You're listening and learning. You're not really talking and actively using those language areas, and you're not writing. Writing is a much less you know, we don't use it every day. And writing really taxes more of the memory areas of the brain for language.
It's one a very interesting thing. You probably could use this. A friend of mine who is a wrote a bestseller said that when she was teaching writing, she said, never use a computer to write. Always write longhand.
Oh, I love that, because I wrote that whole book with a fountain pen on pieces of paper.
Exactly what she said. She said, because you will access more emotions if you use the physical properties than if you're typing on a keyboard.
That's so cool, because when you write, you're using more right hemisphere. You're using visual space.
That's right.
Isn't that cool? That's really slick.
Yeah. Spatial direction sense.
That's what we talked about with the driving, the map.
Uh-huh. Attention, you said skilled movements.
Skilled movements, things like learning how to knit, learning how to do woodworking, build boats, any kind of thing that you're using a different skill, learning how to dance, a different dance. The social thing as well is turning on different radio stations and listening to what the kids are listening to, even though it feels a little irritating to your system, keeping up with what the rest of society does. It taxes your brain, and it makes you mold into different useful pathways that will temper your brain against dementia.
Well, in that way, I guess television must be valuable, because you certainly nowadays, with thousands of channels being available, you could do just about anything.
Well, I force myself to watch certain channels just because I want to see what the kids are doing. I watch, actually, when I'm not on the phone doing work, I actually watch an awful lot of daytime TV, because I don't want to be brought up in a bubble somewhere. You know, just like that guy who had the immune system problem, boy in a bubble. I don't want to be woman in a bubble either, because if you live in a bubble, your brain is not going to change with the world.
We're speaking with a physician, Dr. Mona Lisa Schultz. Mona Lisa, born with the name Mona Lisa, huh, Mona Lisa?
Yep, absolutely.
Tell us a little about that birth name.
Well,
mom, right?
My mother thought, you know, I was going to be a boy. So she doesn't even tell me why she named me Mona Lisa. So I just tell everyone that my mother had an affair with Nat King Cole, and I'm their love child.
That's what you tell me.
The reason why I stopped for a second, I'm thinking, am I going to get called from the estate of Nat King Cole? I'm willing to risk it.
Well, but you know, you said she wanted a boy, or they wanted a boy. So how come you got the name Mona Lisa? Why didn't they call you Sam?
I think it's because the song was playing in labor and delivery, probably.
And it's a pretty thing, and they think of you as a smiling child or something like that. Very interesting, very interesting name to have, and it's the first time I've heard it. And of course, it's good, because it is certainly. I mean, they call you Dr. Mona Lisa, don't they?
Yeah, it's very interesting. I'm a patient. A clinic of patients who are severely disabled. They're like in group homes and very unusual autistic people. And what they do with the radio when they have free reign. One time I went in there and they had changed it from Muzak to the station that was playing 19th Nervous Breakdown by the Rolling Stones. I'm like, would you please turn that off? It's just absolutely.
What's the reaction? That's a very interesting thing. When you have, you work in some homes, and you've seen some of the homes where they run everything by rote for the safety and the comfort to keep the people in their medication regimen and within a certain range. And we know we're killing them by doing that.
Yeah.
We know by having somebody just do repetition upon repetition upon repetition, the same food. Today's Friday, it'll be Jell-O, you know? We know that. What's the difference if somebody like you goes in and says, let's change the station? Let's put on WBAI. Let's listen to a little music.
Well, actually, it's a very interesting, I'll tell you a short story. It's what does the person want and how to keep them safe and live the best potential. I once evaluated this man who was head injured, and he was in a head injury rehab center. So he comes in with his wife, and he comes in with his daughter, and they're all sitting there smiling. And mind you, the state of Maine is paying a lot of money for this guy to be in a rehab center because we are rehabilitating him. So I said, how you doing? Fine. His wife says, fine. The daughter says, fine. Said, any problems? Fine, fine, fine. Everyone says, fine. Everyone's fine. But the rehab center sent him to me. I call him up. Oh, he's terrible. He can't remember anything. He gets lost, blah, 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 blah. And so then I said, well, how come his wife and his daughter aren't complaining? Everyone's fine. And they were all in this because they were all in the same car. They all were head injured. And I went, why are we treating this man? If they are happy the way they are, why are we inflicting what we think is happiness and growth onto them? And for them, to be honest with you, it is dementia. They don't remember anything. Every day is new. And that's not particularly stressful for them because they live in their own little universe and utopia there. And I said, leave this man alone. As long as he has his wife and his daughter, and his daughter's younger than him, this is not, they're not suffering. I think you have to look at the patient, find out what makes the patient happy. With one guy, it's stacking soup cans. As long as he has his Dinty Moore soup cans and he can stack them, he's extremely happy.
Well, he may be happy, but now look, you know just from what your book said, you're either waiting to die or you're growing. And if you're waiting to die, you stack your soup cans. But if you stack your soup cans and there's somebody there who says, let's stack them upside down today and see what happens, even though it would shake up many people with dementia or who are, you know, schizophrenic or any of that, even though it shakes them up, it does in some way help that brain go back to growing.
Well, there is, in the anxiety chapter, I really had a hard time writing about anxiety because basically I have it and the world has it. It's very much related to intuition, and there aren't a lot of medicines that are not addictive that work for it. And then what I learned what anxiety really is the part of our brain that detects change, that detects stress. And all of us have a level, a barometer, I call it the stressometer scale, that is adverse to change and stress. Now, ever since I can remember, I've always gotten sick when there was a change, September to October. A lot of people get sick during changes of life. There's a scale, you know, you lose a wife, you retire, sure. There's a scale of that. So I've learned that some change is good. If we have the absence of change, the part of our brain that can tolerate it atrophies in a way. So I guess you're right. We need to invert the cans in our life and allow some, a little bit of discomfort. Interesting, that particular guy, it's sad, but it's a true story. His parents wanted him to go to Disney World. He's in a wheelchair, and he's very violent, and getting him through security, believe it or not, with those cans, those Dinty Moore cans was a deal. But anyway, he got some medicine. He went down there. The guards tried to take the cans away in security, but he got through. He gets to Disney World, and the only ride he can go to is It's a Small World. It was like sitting here going, the paradox of this is just absolutely unbelievable. But he was able to do it, and even though it was stressful and put everybody out, I think pushing your envelope and being able to withstand a little bit of discomfort is probably good for your brain.
I can tell you the number of times I've been with somebody who was fatally, who didn't have many chances, you know, people with severe cancer. I would take them and I would just get them in a wheelchair and get them outside in the sunlight.
Oh, yeah.
Just to get something growing.
Yes.
You know? You talk about medication, and I want to go on to your belief about medication. There's a lot of different medications that you and your profession easily prescribe. You know, you depression, for example, you could see depression and you say medication is kind of easy for depression. Obsessive compulsiveness medication is easy. What do you think of the risks of medication are and how does it stop working?
Well, I think you've been with me for about 10, 15 minutes. You know, I pretty have profound ADD and I don't take medicine. I think attention deficit disorder is really a normal variant. We all are like cats with different spots, different patterns of brain attention and memory and mood. And for some famous singers who are extreme, they have perfect pitch, their moods are decidedly off key. And giving them and over medicating them or making their moods perfect might dull the intensity that they communicate in their music. I think we'd all admit that if Robin Williams was a complete Ritalin responder, we wouldn't have his entire body of work, and the same for Ellen DeGeneres. So I don't think if there's something different about your moodiness in it, panic, distractibility, whether that means that you, just because it's disordered in certain environments, that you need to medicate it. I think that it's been said that people who are dyslexic, if our culture wasn't so literate, they wouldn't have a disorder. So for me, I actually don't think everybody needs medicine. I think if you're having a problem fitting into a type of work for a short period of time or a type of relationship, you might use a medicine to splint your brain into place so that you can survive and thrive. And then you might be able to rewire your brain with cognitive behavioral therapy or a variety of other resources to be able to adapt to that environment that you might not need the medicine anymore. It's really between you, your doctor, and your conscience about how you want to best use what's available to make your brain and your body work.
We tend to go along the pathway that has the least resistance. So people who feel upset or if people who feel depressed tend to slide into their depression. You're saying that part of even depression itself is part of the risk of the greater brain, of the new brain of women. Do you think that it's that depression is part of our new society as well?
Well, I think it's fascinating you say about the resistance. I've worked with Chris Northrup for over a decade, and I've worked on her books with her, and I've helped her with a lot of the information. And we have fights. We fight. And when we fight, I get upset, and we discover something new. And if I had a medication for that and I didn't get upset, I don't think I would have been able to come up with that information. I haven't known anyone who's been very successful who didn't have extreme emotional states that then brought about some kind of discovery. So talk about resistance. I can't think of anything more adverse than feeling some kind of spasm. I mean, just think about the solutions you've come up with in your life when you thought you were going to go broke. Or you were so upset about this marriage not working. Or and so on. I think that if you medicate those things away, that discomfort wouldn't make you want to change anything. I think it's important. On the other hand, if you're so uncomfortable that you're paralyzed and you can't do anything, then you need a little bit of a splint to help you focus.
What is splint? What do you mean by that?
Well, first of all, the first time I set foot in a unit, I remember someone's mother or wife dying, and the guy comes in the unit, and he's not suicidal, but he wants an antidepressant. And I said, these are not happiness pills. I remember it was the first thing I said professionally as a psychiatrist. And they looked at me and went, oh, no. Because the hospital visit gets paid for by insurance if you prescribe a medicine. And I thought, oh, my God, this just seems so wrong. Nonetheless, I think that a mood splint, if you have a broken leg, you splint the leg in place so that the bone can knit. And then you remove the splint. For me, a mood splint, an antidepressant, it splints your brain into position to help you make the correct changes in your life, that the mood was part of your intuitive guidance system telling you to change.
Speaking with Mona Lisa Schultz, you know, Mona Lisa, I love that you are so much your own person. I really love the way you're doing it. You know, I mean, seriously, as a psychiatrist, as a physician, as a neuroscientist, you've kind of held on to your own way, I could tell. And you're, you know, you're being yourself and you're... You must be very energetically giving to a lot of people, I'm sure.
Well, one of my favorite movies is Hello, Dolly, with Barbara Streisand. It was What's Up, Doc. It's What's Up, Doc. And she says, I know I'm different. I know I'm different. From now on, I'm going to try to be the same. I've tried to be normal. It just does not work for me. So I just do what I do.
And you write The New Feminine Brain. And in your New Feminine Brain, you say, you said something about how a woman's brain is actually different than a man's brain. Do you mind talking about that?
Well, there are traditional women. That's what I call the terminal ruffle. Like Oklahoma, very feminine. And then there's a traditional men who's very, very masculine. But there are some women who are not really girly-whirly. And there are other men who aren't like... very, very burly. So what I mean is...
Girly and burly are two... That's very nice.
Maybe burly doesn't mean guy, but you know what I'm talking about.
I know what you mean.
Language is not my first way of communicating. Anyway...
No. I kind of liked it. You went from girly to burly.
So traditional women have a very bilateral kind of brain. Emotion from the right brain is very interjected into left brain language. So they use both language, two brains in one, to speak. A traditional man would keep... left brain language somewhat segregated from right brain emotion and intuition. So men do have intuition. It's just not they don't talk about it a lot. And men do have emotion and mood. They might not complain about it a lot. But...
how do you account for that again now? You talk about segmentation of the brain what makes the difference?
Compartmentalization.
And the compartmentalization... that's always a rough word.
I know. I just say they keep it separate.
Compartmentalization... In being able to compartment different things, men do it. Now, do men
traditional men?
Right, mostly traditional men have a separation between their emotional selves and their intuitive selves, and their thinking selves and their the functional selves.
Speaking side, yeah.
Speaking side. Now, and you're saying women, they've got kind of bridges that go between the two.
Well, they say that women have 2% wider corpus callosum. That's the highway between the right and the left brain, traditional women. But you take left-handed men, you take left-handed women, You add hormones,
take
away hormones.
Are you saying that a wider corpus callosum gives you a better chance? Now, corpus callosum is that...
Corpus callosum, yes.
Tell people what it is.
It's the highway between the right and the left brain. It takes
But it's the split in the brain. It's the top of your head, isn't it?
Right.
I mean, I'm trying to get people who don't know what corpus callosum is. They may think it's an olive.
It's like the Lincoln Tunnel between Jersey and Manhattan. Is that
so? If you're going to choose your man, it might be ideal to try to find out how big his corpus callosum is.
Actually, you could, and there's a part of the book that actually shows you that. There's ways that you can meet the guy at dinner. Like tonight, I'm giving a lecture, but we could all be watching Hooking Up on ABC. And I'm sitting there watching these women go on their first dates. I'm like, no, have him go to the table, get a knife and come back. By which way he turns when he gets the fork and comes back, you can tell what side of the brain.
No, wait a minute. What do you mean by which way he turns?
Turning. The man, if you say, can you do me a favor? Can you go to that table over there, get me a fork and come back?
Yeah.
He takes the fork. He'll walk over, take the fork. What way he turns tells you which way he's lateralized.
The way he turns his body?
Yes, it comes back and returns.
You mean if he spins clockwise or counterclockwise?
Once I went, and then there's the hair whirls.
Well, let's stick in this for a minute, because, you know, we've got a lot of people out there who are trying to hook up. Do you recommend a guy who turns clockwise or counterclockwise?
I'd go counterclockwise.
The guy who goes counterclockwise is more likely to have a bigger corpus callosum.
Yep, and if you ask him to keep going back to that table three or four times, you have obsessive compulsive disorder, and you yourself need to be evaluated. The other thing you need to do is, if he still has hair, and there's ways of getting around this problem, you check his hair whorls. My editor once took me to the dog show, and we were sitting way up on the top of the garden, and she's looking at the dogs, and I'm looking at people's heads, because you can see the way their hair turns. We're more familiar with a baby. You can see the hair turning around in a circle, spiraling. And usually, for most people who are left brain dominant for language, men, their hair whorl will be on the left side of their back of their head.
Hair whorl, W-H-I-R-L.
Yeah, I come from Rhode Island. We mispronounce everything. Anyway, however, if it's on the right side, that means it's very atypical. I would keep him. He'd be more likely to talk about his emotions. If he has both sides, emotional, but you got to check out some learning disabilities. I was actually telling this to my hairdresser once, and he was like, wow, really? And I said, why? And he said, because you have two, one on one each side. And I'm like, thanks a lot. Higher instance of mental retardation. Anyway, you can tell a lot by someone in their hair whorls.
And so I can imagine guys nowadays hearing this, going to their hairdressers and saying, put my hair whirl on the other side.
Yeah, you know, you could do that with plastic surgery. Yeah. Just pull the whole scalp over.
This is Armand DeMille. Do you think we're silly? This is Armand DeMille. We're talking about a different woman's brain and a man's brain being different, and we're talking about them as being two different brains giving access in different ways, and the need for us to have developed a higher brain, you know, to have developed a more brain. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about intuition, which is the other book that you wrote. What's the name of that book, Mona Lisa?
This part of the book. This book has intuition in the last chapter and the fourth chapter, but there's another book called Awakening Intuition.
Awakening Intuition, which I remember as well. We're going to be back with you in a couple of minutes. Armand DeMille.
Hi, this is Danny Glover. You're tuned in to WBAI, listener-supported, non-commercial radio in New York.
Turn with us now to those thrilling days of yesteryear. From out of the past come the historic sounds of radio's bygone days. The golden age of radio rides again.
Ali Abdar Khan, Lullaby, one of my favorites. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind, WBAI, in case you've just tuned in, 99.5. We are speaking with the highly spirited, brilliant, intelligent friend of Christine Northrup and lady from Rhode Island. What was it about Rhode Island you said? You know, I thought about that a little later. You were born on what part of Rhode Island?
On an island near Newport, Rhode Island.
Near Newport. So you were on an island on the island of Rhode Island.
Well, Rhode Island is like affixed to the United States, but Aquidneck Island is an island.
And you were on Aquidneck?
Yeah.
And how long of your life were you on Aquidneck?
I was on there for 18 years.
Now, for the first 18 years of your life, therefore, wherever you had to go over a bridge.
Yeah.
How did that affect your mind? Well, I mean, what did that do? You were really isolated.
I never really thought about that until I tried to apply for a residency.
Uh-huh.
And it really influenced where I went. I was on the West Coast for about a year, and the water was on the wrong side. I swear to you, it really felt like it was, because I've always oriented to the water being a certain place. And then when I was in Boston, it's like living near the water has always brought me comfort. When you're in the mountains, I always feel claustrophobic.
So having the water all around you and being on an island, the first 18 years of a life must have done something to your mind as well.
Actually, the only way that I can sit still and feel calm is if I hear ocean.
Should I pour something out of it? Keep a little something going. You know, they did a great study on the ocean, the sound of the ocean. They tried to mimic, I forgot, what were the waves they used, and they found some correlation between the sound of sperm, right? They were able to make that sound. They amplified that sound, and it was identical to the sound of the ocean.
It's very calming.
Somewhere in our way back when, before we became anything.
I never thought about that with the sperm thing. I've never thought of sperm as calming, but I think the ocean is.
You were one once, you know.
Yeah, you're right.
You know, it's hard to believe. And so is everybody with a new feminine brain. Men have feminine brains.
Exactly. You know how you read every once in a while, they say we only use 10% of our brain? I think it's because the 90% that they're talking about is in the right brain. And in the man, it's more compartmentalized. The right brain is less readily accessible. If you're left-handed, that's different. And women now today, when you put yourself in the workforce, when you climb the social status ladder, you get more power. You actually get more testosterone. And your brain gets more of the style of a man's. That's why you say walk like a man, talk like a man, but still a woman inside gives you challenges. Over time can make you feel like you're going to snap. And at midlife, it can make you feel like your brain is turning into a Q-tip. So now to exist in the world, I think men are having to learn how to download more of the right brain files for emotionality and for intuition and be able to talk about it. And women are learning how to both use their brain that they were born with, the feminine brain, and then come to peace with the ways that they've had to mold it to shape it into a man's world.
So the new feminine brain is a brain that has adapted based on changes that have taken place in the needs, because we really don't need a guy to go out there with a stick and kill a deer anymore to go bring it home to eat. And we don't need the woman to just have babies and pick the best possible fertile mate.
Well, the way that men hunted before for large groups of animals is now the corporate takeover.
Right.
The way that woman hunted and gathered is now the multi-level marketing network in which she would run her business. Men have had to learn more of the feminine ways of business for sustainability. You can't like just rape and pillage the world and take something. You have to learn how the more feminine, and this is not just to do with women, men have this capability, you have to enculturate it in your own brain, and how the relatedness of all living things, like say there's oil in Alaska. We don't just take the oil and leave holes. You have to figure out how it has to do with having empathy for the rest of the land there. And the same for women. women to survive in the world, you can't always take your right brain emotion and talk about it. I remember once in the eighth grade, I started crying, and the guidance counselor, don't you love it, guidance counselor?
What a word.
It was unbelievable. This is what the guidance counselor guided me in. I was crying, and he said, you're never going to be able to exist in the world and be successful if you cry all the time. And so I had to learn how to put a little tourniquet around my corpus callosum, segregate some of my emotions in my right brain, and let my left brain focus on the task at hand and get through a BA and an MD and a PhD. I mean, defending a thesis. They're yelling at you, and you can't cry.
It's amazing, isn't it?
It's painful and a pain in the neck.
What an ordeal.
It was terrible. They said it was the most bloodiest thing they'd ever seen. 3 hours of screaming. It was very, very hard. And so...
What was your paper?
The somatotopic arrangement of fibers in the motor system in a rhesus monkey.
I actually know what you're talking about.
It just means that there's a place for the leg, there's a place for the hand, there's a place for the foot. It still looks like my sock drawer.
Right, and then, so organized. You have to defend that.
I did. But they ask you about everything in the motor system in perpetuity, or however you pronounce it. And it wasn't about the motor system. Just like, you know, Armstrong says it's not about the bike. It was learning how to be a woman in a man's system and learn how to take my feminine brain and not cry like the guidance counselor said, even though they tell you you're terrible, they tell you all this stuff. It's hazing.
Do you think they would have actually denied you your degree if you cried while you were answering your questions?
I knew some people in my PhD program. They would use words like, and I remember in my department as a psychiatrist, the words they use women, unprofessional.
It's unprofessional to weep while people are challenging you.
Yeah, because you look like you've lost control. You have to take that part of your brain that can compartmentalize emotions. If for the time being, at least. I mean, then afterwards, you don't ask what happened after July 2nd, 1991. I did three months of medicine, 3 months of surgery, and then I blew 2 discs in my neck that started a chain reaction down my spine. So a woman can only act... And we act like a man for so long to survive. And if you do it for any long time, it takes its toll on your body.
Because your emotions, they use the body as a theater.
Right. So if your right brain emotions don't get a left brain outlet, they simmer, marinate, and then ooze down in your body, and they increase your chance toward illness. It does it in a man, too. It just takes longer. So it takes its toll on me. And so I've had, a very colorful history. Blue Cross Blue Shield, Massachusetts and Maine. I know what it's like to have to take your brain and be a woman but still survive in a man's world.
Mm. And you've paid the dues for it.
Yeah, but
you've paid the dues in the form of your body being broken. Oh. It actually broke your spine.
Oh, I have rods. My back looks like the Brooklyn Bridge sitting on its end. I have rods in my spine from C... My neck to the rest of my spine is completely fused. I look like a rotisserie. You just turn around. You rotate around. But I think it's an exaggeration of what happens to every one of us. We get broken by the system, and we need to learn how to find our unique genius, cultivate it, but also survive and thrive. And for me, it was learning how to use my intuition, right brain intuition, and balance it with my left brain intellect. Doing either one or the other made me snap.
See, very intensely, you've focused on the changes of the brain, but you've kind of gotten to the idea that there are certain ways of developing your mind and other ways not to. And this, I'm going to go to your behavioral approach to kind of regenerating brain cells.
Uh-huh.
In other words, if you've got a mind, you believe knitting is okay, right?
If I was anxious...
Well...
If I was prone to anxiety,
mm-hmm.
I would do a repetitive behavior that was calming and soothing. So, severely mentally retarded people, they do rhythmic behavior. They knit. I mean, they rock. People with more adapted brains are more likely to do a repetitive behavior, not rocking, but knitting or scrapbooking. When 9/11 went up, I watched it on TV, and I felt the compulsion to go to Michael's, this craft store, and buy over a dozen of those little light-out houses, Christmas tree, Department 52. And I built an entire village. I had no idea what I was doing. This is like that movie, can't remember with the aliens, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, when the guy made this little mountain that mm-hmm. was like a model of... For me, I made this entire village, and I had no idea what I was doing, was making this little village with streetlights, with a waterfront, with all these people who walked around, these people, until I showed pictures of it to my friends, and they said, oh, I want to live there. It looks so peaceful. And it was my way of reenacting and undoing a trauma world that we had found ourselves in. And so repetitive craft behavior decreases anxiety. So knitting, scrapbooking, stamping can be very soothing, and it lowers anxiety.
You know, it's kind of interesting that you get a chance to observe that. You grew up with that, right? Didn't you have a dad who was a crafts guy?
Yeah, my father did wood. In fact, that was my first evaluation. He used to build, like, the molding along the sides of the house, and he used to make all the knobs and cabinets, and I would take the wood.
That's very fine work. I mean,
it's very fine work. And I would take the wood, and I'd make highway systems instead of reading. So they took me to be evaluated, and they said, no, my mother says, is she retarded? And they went, no, she's just a very unusual brain. Because my sister would be reading Little House on the Prairie, what I call bonnet books, mm-hmm. and I would be building systems.
And your dad, was he calm? Was he a peaceful guy?
Yeah, he was very calm. Anxious, though, very anxious.
So an anxious kind of guy who followed exactly what you're saying, he had a craft.
And he did it. It was very soothing to him.
And the craft is what paid. You know, a lot of people think, Mona Lisa, that the... that meditation is the answer to all anxiety. What do you think?
I would say for left brain dominant right-handed people, for some people that would be good. But just like anything in excess, whether it was alcohol, sugar, or anything, if you do it in excess, it's not good for your brain. Meditation, we know from the book Why God Won't Go Away, wonderful book. PET scans have been done by people who are meditating. And what it does is it makes the right parietal area go to sleep while you're meditating. And the right parietal area is extremely important. It's kind of a very slick concept. When you meditate, that brain goes to sleep. It's the part of the brain that divides attention from extrapersonal space, someone outside of me, to interpersonal space inside of me. So in other words, I now know that you're over there and I'm over here. But if I meditate, you and I are one. And if you stay in that system, in meditation, with your right brain a little bit asleep, right parietal lobe especially, you're not using that brain for other things. And we've shown that people who have unusual styles of attention, if you want to call it attention deficit disorder, go ahead, that chronically meditating may initially make you feel calm, but it's going to make your brain over time feel very fuzzy.
Well, let me understand why I kind of... There's a part of me that's in agreement with this because I've seen enough people come by this mental health center who have spent a lot of time meditating, but they haven't really solved anything. They've just been driven inward. You're saying that when you meditate, the way the brain works is you tend to fuse everything together.
Yeah.
And you think it's important to keep things separate.
At times.
In order to keep the brain in its proper practice.
I think there's times to be in a meditative state where you and I are one, and there's other times that you're over there and I'm over here because I was put on the earth to do some things, and I got to pay attention to the taxes, I got to pay attention to my kids, I got to pay my bills, and I got to think about, oh my God, I'm speeding, why am I speeding? If I put myself in a meditative state, I'm like, ooh, you and I are one. It's as if nothing matters, and it's the normal feeling of pain and urgency, which is important to change our lives, is deadened. And I think that that is not very helpful over time.
You make a case also for cleaning your house. How does cleaning your house, just to move your brain a little bit, see the way I flipped you out of that into that? Ba-dum.
Well,
you're quick. You've got a very flexible brain. Cleaning your house can be a positive experience. Of course it can be a positive experience because you've got a clean house.
If you have, it's an adaptive skill for anxiety. If you have a goal and you're overwhelmed by that goal, say you've got to write a term paper or you've got to get a new job or you've got to do something, the house becomes a metaphor for your psyche. And you, just like the goal, you need to break it down into doable tasks, doable steps. Choosing an area of your house, like a closet or a desktop, to master, to organize, to file away, becomes a metaphor for a part of that problem that you can now solve. And by ordering the things like putting all the files in a file cabinet or cleaning up that one closet, then as you're putting away the shoes and you're lining them up and you're putting all the hangers in one direction, you are slowly also sorting out those files of worry. Then when you stand back and look at your closet, you go, ooh, it looks so nice. You've built mastery. And mastery increases opiates, which makes everything seem like it's, oh, not so bad, so that you can then approach that problem. So cleaning, but if you then feel compelled to clean every single room of your house, the garage, and then every other house down the road, you're not doing anxiety and mastery. You're doing avoidance.
Is this a little like retroactive inhibition and proactive inhibition, where you're taking one particular task that you have, and by changing the task onto something else that will help you in some way organize your mind, it makes the learning of your first task more efficient?
Oh, I know what you're talking about, that thing.
You remember that thing?
All those words. We called it priming the pump.
Right.
We
have a similar
retroactive
background.
Priming the pump meant, well, when I first worked in the gonorrhea lab, there was a machine you had to run the buffer through. You had to run the buffer through that so that the tubing was coated so that when you ran your sample through, the experiment worked well. It's saying, like, if you clean the closet, you're warming up the apparatus, so when you get on, you can do your routine for the judges. So by doing the small closet, you're warming up your brain so that you can then approach the difficult task.
And sometimes you have to go away from the difficult task because your brain is just too jumbled to go to the simple task, so that your mind can become simple enough to sort through things.
Yeah, you need to put spaces in your synapse.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's time just to go out. Well, especially before your period, I used to figure out my attention and my capacity for doing tasks by my period. And right before my period, I would, you know, not be able to do surgeries or things. And so that was a day to cover slip. You know, you do your microscope slides. And cover slipping is a mindless but pseudo-meditative task.
What's a cover slip?
Oh, it's a slide, and you just put this little piece of saran wrap on top, and you don't want to get any
that cover slip.
In.
I'm sorry, I thought you were talking about something embedding.
It's basically you.
No, it's a slide on top of a slide.
So basically, you are doing mindless, repetitive activity, and it just opens up the synapses in your brain so that when it's time to do the more difficult thing, you've rested.
My guest, Dr. Mona Lisa Schultz, a neuropsychiatrist, neuroscientist, medical intuitive. Received her doctorate in behavioral neuroscience from the Boston University, author of The New Feminine Brain and How Women and Men Can Develop Their Inner Strengths, Genius, and Intuition. She defends the right of the brain to be disorganized because says that it's a growing entity. Let's go to the menstrual cycle for a minute, okay?
What a break. Moving on right to the menstrual cycle.
Yeah, well, you have a lot to say about it.
Well, the menstrual cycle is a way that a woman can try out different brains across the month. So the first half of the month, she's more in her left brain. She can be more likely to feel positive emotions and be able to be more rational. But after she ovulates, her right brain is more dominant, and she's more likely to experience intuitive states, and unfortunately at times intense emotional states. When you get into menopause, you get stuck on that ambi-brain, right brain state. And, you know, then they call you a wise, intuitive old woman, and they throw you in a hut because they don't want to hear what you have to say. It really doesn't
matter. Because you're always complaining.
You're always complaining because you don't have the left brain frontal lobe sensor. you know what I'm saying.
I do.
You become more what I would call more incontinent. Your emotions ooze out. So the menstrual cycle gives you, across the month, different times to try in different types of brains.
So would you say that it is not, even though you have a tremendous feeling of emotionality post, in the second half, that this is not the time to make your big decisions?
Oh.
Because your decisions are going to be based on this incredible emotionality that you feel. Is this a time to kind of at least ask yourself, well, whatever I'm feeling now, whatever decision I make now, I'm going to check back with myself in 2 weeks?
Well, I hate to say this. I hate to be oppositional and defiant, but suppose you're a kind of person who's complacent and you have what I would call a Dolly Parton left hemisphere, which means that you're very easily mute and censor your emotions and you're going to do status quo. So the first part of your month, you're less likely to act on your intuition, and you're more likely to stay in an abusive relationship. You really need that snapping of the right brain during the premenstrual time to really say, you know what, damn it, I've had it. I'm out of here. You can say damn on the radio, I hope. You can, and I'm leaving. And so for those people, they call it PMS. Her partner might want to take her to the doctor and say, medicate her, she's snapping. That snapping, that emotion oozing out, emotional incontinence before a period, is part of her intuitive guidance system. That's the new feminine brain saying, I am out of here. I think also men do this too. Midlife crisis, as their testosterone goes down, the relative level of estrogen goes up, and all of a sudden, going out and being corporate takeover is not going to get their rocks moving. They want to stay home and be with their partner more. So I think that our brains are evolving in a way to feel more emotion incorporated into our intellect and consciousness and create health.
It sounds like you could trust yourself more, but you have a real, you're really committed to being able to feel emotions but not take emotions too far, right?
Well, you know, you need your temporal lobe emotions and intuition, and you need to use your frontal lobe to censor them. Know when to say what to who at the right amount of intensity. You don't want to be a temporal lobe on a stick. You don't want to just be raw, unbridled emotions.
It's so pretty, a temporal lobe on
a stick. You know what I'm saying? They're, like, they're kids. Kids, what they want, they go after. Stimulus, response. Supermarket, they see the chocolate, it's in their mouth. They see a breast, it's in the hand. We evolve frontal lobes to curb our behavior, curb our emotions, and make us not blurt out our intuition. Some people have somewhat AA frontal lobes, where it oozes out, and, you know, they might be called a psychic from hell. You know, they go up to you during conference, ooh, check out left kidney, not good. And it's like too much sharing. So we really need to access our frontal lobe skills for bridling our intuition at times, censoring it and directing it in a skillful way.
We have to be able to calm ourselves down. In other words, just feeling your emotions and expressing your emotions constantly without...
Oh, that's wrong. It's not going to be good. You've got to, the word emotion means to create movement. But all movement is not good. We need skilled movement.
So you don't believe in the cathartic, constant emotional expression, you know, just rage and rage and rage and rage, and that eventually you're going to get to the bottom of the rage.
Give me an example. A friend of mine, actually, no, it's a patient. A patient of mine has very abusive background, very traumatic. So she's very emotional, she's prone to panic, and she's prone to depression. She goes to Africa, and she works with all these prostitutes, and she finds herself abreacting all of their emotion and grief. She cries, cries, cries. And what does she do? She ends up making her mood disorder worse because she creates rug burns in her brain. By abreacting for 6 months on end, she actually makes her mood problem worse. So just experiencing your emotions without appropriate timing, abreacting all the time, is not helpful.
I want to thank you very much. It's Mona Lisa Schultz, the author with us of The New Feminine Brain. You can read it, New Feminine Brain, Mona Lisa Schultz, S-C-H-U-L-Z. This is Armand DeMille with you at The Positive Mind. A copy of today's program, 212-757-4488. Do check out our website. Much stuff available there, thepositivemind.com.
Tune to listener-supported, commercial-free community radio WBAI in New York at 99.5 FM. Coming up at 2 p.m. will be Perspective with Louis Reyes Rivera. So stay tuned for that talk back with Hugh Hamilton at 3 p.m. Ear it again. It says ear it again. Serene, you're something else. WBAI archives up and running, proving the effectiveness of teamwork. Local and national staff have launched the WBAI Archive Project. Some public affairs programs can be podcast and all can be downloaded or streamed for 90 days. Music programs may be heard for 14 days. Just go to archive.wbai.org and select your favorite program by name or date. All right, so archives on WBAI. Many thanks to the hard work of our staff, particularly Pete Caracas. Thank you very much. Don't forget, upcoming Perspective with Luis Reyes Rivera and The Positive Mind with Armand DeMille back Tuesday at 1 p.m.
On Thursday, August 18th, Harlem Independent Living Center will be sponsoring Alcohol Awareness Day, Alcohol and Your Health. Many community organizations will participate, including Harlem Hospital Department of Rehabilitative Medicine, Disability Network of New York City, Harlem Interagency Council on Aging, and the Mayor's Office of People with Disabilities. That's Thursday, August 18th, from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m., at the State Office Building, Adam Clayton Powell Boulevard and 125th Street. For more information, call the Harlem Independent Living Center at 212-222-7122. That's 212-222-7122. Learn more about alcohol and your health at the Alcohol Awareness Day.
WBAI.
I want my freedom.
New York.
Ah!
99.5 FM.
You gotta get me my freedom!
Streaming on www.wbai.org. Freedom of Speech Radio.
The blues don't mean that you lose.
What do you mean, brother?
Well, I think that's the bottom line question people are asking.
Dance is the spiritual search.
That stuff was funky.
You don't have to add anything. It's already perfect and pristine in its original condition.
My God, he's playing a different one every time.
The observer becomes aware that which he is observing is himself.
I'm so glad you gave me permission for that.
It's all good.
Thank you for inviting me, Ibrahim. It's a pleasure to be here with you in your studio.
Da 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 da. Behind door number three.
I'm gonna get ya.
What a pleasant surprise.
The purpose of the visit was to pay our respect to the lineage.
That's what music is about. And that's what art is about, to uplift us and to create excellence in our lives.
It's been a pleasure being here, and thank you for inviting me, Ibrahim. Best of luck.
In the Moment with Ibrahim Gonzalez. Friday mornings from 3:30 to 6 a.m. on 99.5 FM, WBAI.
Please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive.